Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Today, from China Medical University, we're going to hear about how consuming allims, like onions or garlic or chives, are found to lower colorectal cancer risk by 79% just by themselves. This was published in the Asia Pacific Journal of Clinical Oncology. So, wow, that's a big drop in colorectal cancer if you have your onions and garlic. And I suggest eating raw sweet onions. Remember the concept. An onion a day keeps a stroke away because it helps thin the blood. But it also is good for the bacteria in your gut. And it's antibacterial and antiviral. Garlic is a whole different really helper for your body's immune system. But we're going to get into all that at the beginning of our program. And then today, time permitting, I'd like to take a look at the demonstrations, legitimate ones, by for the people who are concerned about police violence and or the profiling or all the different ways that the police have been involved, or at least some of the police have been involved in not honoring their commitment to protect and serve. I'll give my own solutions to what could be done, but also separate out those from those who are there not because they want to honor someone who was killed unjustly, but because they have a political or ideological agenda that they want to focus and galvanize and hence capture the moment with. Now, when you combine that, then it's very divisive. Because the media doesn't quite know how to handle that, or they know perfectly how to handle it. They can weaponize these demonstrations, which are legitimate in their concern, to that which is not legitimate, and using that to turn elections and then to create a new social order. Possible? Well, they've been trying. We're going to offer some insights on that, and then I'll ask you to call in and share your points of view. Also, on a regular basis, we've been sharing with you updates on why what we've been told about the coronavirus is either incomplete, incorrect, or out-and-out lies, and why we have a whole world that has been adversely affected because of misinformation. Now, that's also been captured by both groups as a political tool or a weapon for the Trump administration, fast-tracking a whole series of over 200 vaccines, all of them experimental, none of them being used in the proper way with the gold standard placebo over a period of time. Instead, they're being fast-tracked. That I'm opposed because I saw what happened when you fast-track a drug like AZT that, in my opinion, in my research, caused the death of tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of HIV-positive or otherwise healthy people within the gay community. And the person who is responsible for that, Anthony Fauci, is responsible today for fast-tracking these vaccines. And yet he's looked upon as a hero, much like the corporate left looked upon Comey and the FBI, Brennan and the CIA, Clapper and the National Security Agency, traditional enemies of honesty, decency, and our rights. They have been culpable in so many crimes in the United States and outside the United States, and yet suddenly you couldn't go a day without seeing them on CNN and NBC, etc. So the same thing is happening today. If you say that you've got a vaccine, everybody's for it. But then if you have a medicine that could help actually cure people, approve a medicine, FDA approved, oh no, they attack it. So we've just been given conflicting information. The average person is not a scientist or a journalist, doesn't know how to unravel all this. We have, we will. Plus today, a 60-minute piece, good for them, an outstanding piece, where what we've been telling you, they're going to show you. So we were right all along. Remember I said the test that they're giving you is inaccurate with high false positives or high false negatives. And frequently when people are given a test and it shows, oh, you've got the coronavirus, there's no proof you have the coronavirus in that test. And now they politically mandate that you have to be quarantined or put you on some aggressive treatment. I know people that have gone into hospital to test themselves for the coronavirus had to wait 7 to 10 days in the hospital, quarantined with people who had coronavirus, and then end up with the coronavirus that they didn't have when they went in, and then get aggressively treated, including with the respirators, and die. No one's taken responsibility. Well, 60 Minutes exposed that. We've exposed it. I'm going to expose more today. That does not mean that the coronavirus is not real. It is. It doesn't mean it's not easily, very easily infecting people. It's an extremely easy virus to pick up. But also, it is most deadly in those who have comorbidities, but not for the rest of the population. In fact, it is less lethal, according to the actual statistics, not the made-up statistics, as a yearly flu. So we're going to unravel all that. And I'm going to give you my view of how we can deal peacefully. That is the key. Remember, I've been in over 1,000 demonstrations. I've led hundreds of demonstrations on a variety of topics. Way back in 1960s on DDT, there was only a handful of us back then, using the great marine biologist Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, and then all the other things we've demonstrated against around the country. But we did so peacefully. We did so by using education. And we didn't engage in the vulgarities. We didn't engage in any looting, burning, fistfights, none of that. I'm opposed to that, and I will go on the record. I believe in protest. I'm against violent protest. And yet today, the media will not dare say that it was a violent protest. It's always peaceful protest, leaving out that part of the agenda where, for whatever their reasons, the violence is going on at the same time, and that should be called out so that the legitimacy of the original demonstration is not lost by being brought together with the two. Anyhow, I'm going to give you what the world religions all have in common in dealing with crisis, and I believe it is an answer. You don't have to be religious. You can be an atheist, agnostic, or a person of faith. And it doesn't matter which faith, these solutions are very positive. That's our program, so let's begin. In a recent study published in the Asian Pacific Journal of Clinical Oncology, Chinese researchers found that eating high amounts of alum, A-L-L-I-U-M, those are the vegetables corresponding to an almost 80% reduction in colorectal cancer risk, and this was done at the first hospital of China Medical University, and this is not the first to show that garlic and onions are good. All cruciferous vegetables are good. That would mean broccoli, broccoli sprouts, cauliflower, kale, watercress, radishes are very good. All that helps. But the higher the amount of garlic and onions in your diet, the greater the reduction of colorectal cancer, which is a very deadly cancer. Well, the most difficult to treat using orthodoxy. In fact, Professor Mary Flynn, Professor of Medicine at Brown University, which is in Rhode Island, noted that although these findings are interesting, you have to focus upon the fact that colorectal cancer is just a family of the disease that can be impacted, meaning if something can help one cancer, why couldn't you assume until such proof exists that it might help other cancers in the body? Why not use these things preventatively? If you can have a potato leek soup or shallots in a shiitake mushroom, then sauteed in with brown rice. If you can have garlic and onion, then you're fighting cancer all over the body. You're also bringing down your blood pressure. Because that's what they do. Why? Because the sulfur-containing active components, that's what's the anti-cancer. And so I suggest garlic and onions all the time. In fact, there was a recent article in the journal Cancer Prevention Research where a team of scientists highlighted the ability of the allium vegetables to prevent different types of cancer. And so have your garlic, have your onions, and help prevent cancer. And there are thousands of studies in the peer-reviewed journals supporting this. From the National Institutes of Scientific Research in Montreal shows that there is a definite confirmed link between a healthy diet and prostate cancer prevention. The Canadian Cancer Society estimates that more than 23,000 Canadians will be diagnosed with prostate cancer this year. And among the risk factors, more and more studies point to a diet that is a processed diet, the common American diet, but it's common also, that can lead to diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and obesity. In fact, if you're overweight, you're more susceptible to diabetes, heart attacks, strokes, and cancer. And so they showed that when they looked at the diets of Canadians from 2005 to 2012, that you were much more likely to end up with prostate cancer if you had a typical processed diet. So go towards a high-quality, healthy, plant-based diet if you want to protect your body and prostate in the process. Also, it's lessening breast cancer. From Ohio University, an article published in the Journal of Experimental Psychology shows that humans are impatient, even down to seconds. That's correct. An Ohio University study seeking to understand the psychological mechanisms of waiting for a larger reward in contrast to instant gratification with a smaller reward. Well, this was the Journal of the American Psychological Association, and it showed, yeah, most people are going to go towards the impatient, give it to me now, and hence the whole concept of fast foods. Everything is fast, speeded up. We're hyperkinetic, and then that becomes hardwired. And then when you're asked to sit and read something, you don't want to. You want to watch something, it got to be quick. Give me the short answer. Go to the answer, just real quick. I don't need any. And that kind of impatience doesn't allow depth of understanding. So we are impatient, and a lot of that is that we reward in the abstract, meaning we don't consider what is the likelihood that if I'm having these French fries instead of a baked potato, or if I'm having this steak instead of a veggie burger, what is it going to do to my health? I'm hungry. I want it now. So impatience shows that we're also lacking discipline. And without that discipline, how are we to master anything? Then we expect to take a one-weekend workshop, pay $2,000 and become a grand Reiki master healer. It's nonsense. You know, it's nonsense. I remember a couple years ago, I was asked by a person, could they use my books and articles in teaching people, wellness counselors? And I said, well, tell me about your curriculum. How much reading? How much studying? How much original work are they going to do? What kind of patients are they going to see? How many clinical hours will they put into this? And there was like this blank. What do you mean? No, they just have to read a certain amount of books and, you know, write a paper and that's it. I said, well, that's not teaching someone how to be a real counselor. It takes time. I'll give you one example. I had a meeting once back in the early 1970s with Dr. Martin Feldman, and he was a professor over at Mount Sinai. He was a board certified in neurology. He was a super geek, number one in his class at Yale and top of his class at Columbia, Physicians and Surgeons, published 63 articles up to that point in peer-reviewed journals. I mean, he was a real scientist. But he saw that he was not getting the results, and he wanted to take over a person's practice. And so he asked me, could I see how this is done? I said, sure. So I would ask people who came in every day, is it all right if Dr. Feldman sits in on the session? He's at the other end of the room sitting on a couch. Yeah. And so every night, even though he worked all day in his office, he would come over there at 6 at night and be till midnight, 6 hours. And then he would ask questions after the people left. He did that for over a year and a half, until he finally felt that he had enough input to understand different approaches to problems, and that's when he took over the practice. of another doctor, and those of you who saw him knew that he would give you everything he could to resolve an issue. And he did. He saved thousands of lives. So from my perspective, that kind of educational and clinical meritocracy shows that he wasn't taking shortcuts. He was patient. There was no rushing. And he stayed on point until we understood something. We don't have that today as we once had. If everything is too fast, too congested, too much, as a result, people lose their own balance in the process of trying to help other people. So that's one of the things that we've learned from this study. I think it's important. Just remember, every time you take a shortcut, every time that you are taking the quick fix, instead of resolving your issues where you're stressed or you feel somehow burdened by something that's happened early in life, maybe some trauma, instead of taking the tranquilizer, instead of taking the drugs, the marijuana or the methamphetamine to put you in a different space in your brain biochemistry, it doesn't resolve anything. When you come out of that stupor, that artificial dopamine or serotonin stimulated high, everything is the same. If you took the time to process how trauma impacts us and how to understand that everything that's ever happened to you will be there the rest of your life, you simply have to learn the art of not connecting with it. You're aware of it, but your awareness allows you to say, nope, I'm not going to go there, because if I do, I'm going to then put on my jacket with all the merit badges. I'm a victim. I'm in pain. I suffer, blah, blah, blah. I'm going to engage in self-pity. No, stop and say, I'm alive and well and wiser because of what's happened to me in my life, both the best and worst that's happened to me. The worst has strengthened me and allowed me to also understand the power of forgiveness. In Judaism, there's a concept of forgive the sinner, remember the sin. And in life, we could apply that. Also from Bar Ilion University in Israel, low vitamin D3 is associated with an increased risk of COVID-19 infection. So vitamin D, as we have stated and have written in two articles and numerous broadcasts, is recognized as an important cofactor in several physiological processes linked with bone and calcium metabolism, but also in diverse non-skeletal outcomes, including autoimmunity diseases, cardiovascular disease, type 2 diabetes, obesity, and cognitive decline and infections, all of which you're going to increase if you don't have enough vitamin D. In particular, pronounced impact of vitamin D metabolites on the immune system response and on the development of COVID-19 infection by the novel SARS-CoV-2 virus has been previously described in many studies, but we're not using it. And this was in the FEBS journal, a scientific journal. And the question is why? With all the natural nutrients, vitamin C, vitamin C drips, ozone, hyperbaric oxygen, astragalus, paldearco, bee propolis, echinacea, all of which help the immune system, and zinc, why is there no discussion anywhere in the scientific community going public that control the airwaves or in the media? Could it have anything to do with the fact that the advertisers and the people who buy the ads want you to look only at their new patented drug that will cost thousands of dollars instead of these inexpensive drugs that have been shown to cure COVID in 100% of patients and many doctors? The evidence is there. We've got to wake up. Plus, get a person healthy, get a person strong in an assisted living center or nursing home or hospice care, and suddenly that person is going to live a longer life, and that comorbidity they're originally suffering from can be addressed and improved so they're not susceptible. But we don't do that. And that's why I say everything has been weaponized so it can be commodified, especially everything on COVID. And finally, from Johns Hopkins University, taking N-acetylcysteine improves cone function in retinitis pigmentosa patients. That's good. So take a look at having that. If you've got retinitis pigmentosis, N-acetylcysteine can make a difference. All right? And that's the latest study. So we are 20 minutes into our program. We're going to take a break, and when we come back from the break, we're going directly to a 60 Minutes piece to talk about the consistent inaccuracies in COVID-19 testing and reporting. Remember, we have been terrified to a point where political action is mandated that supersedes our personal and civil and constitutional rights by governors and by mayors and by the president. So you must be quarantined. If you come outside, if you're alone at a beach, as a person was in New Jersey, you'll be arrested. Of course, 200,000 people protesting side by side, and suddenly there's a spike in the incidents. Well, that had nothing to do with it. God, man. Journalists are so compromised today. Well, fortunately, common sense is not. So once you build up artificially a false narrative, and the false narrative is we have this massive amount of people are infected, which means they're going to die, and that's not true. Of the people infected, 99.7% will not die. So therefore, when you look at how many people are dying, and then you say, well, would they have died had they not been treated this way, and all the, you know, having a person that's got COVID at the advanced stage, and then they go in, back into a nursing home, and then every single patient in the nursing home is affected, and they all die. That's not a legitimate way of adding those statistics, and then all the funeral homes adding in COVID, no matter what the cause of death, and then people being told they have positive COVID, and they never even got tested, and then having no study that's accurate. To this day, right now, I'm saying unequivocally, there is no gold standard for an absolutely universal antibody test. And even if you were testing for antibodies, there is no proof thus far that these antibodies are protective. And even if they're slightly protective, it's about 2 months. That would mean that the vaccine would have to be given 6 times in a year to protect you for a year. What are the side effects of the vaccine? Why did they cover up all the side effects in their latest pronouncements? It's there. You can read it in the study. So you see, we've been lied to because everybody's looking at the gold ring of hundreds of billions of dollars, Bill Gates of becoming the first world's trillionaire, and at what cost and risk. This is bad science all the way. Back in a moment with a 60-minute piece. Please stay with us.
Wyatt Earp, the gunslinger who helped tame the American West, once said, "Fast is fine, but accuracy is final." The same thing could be said about testing for COVID-19. Back in March, the Food and Drug Administration took the unprecedented step of allowing COVID antibody tests to flood the market without review. The tests were billed as a critical tool to assess where the virus had spread and who might have immunity. But in the government's rush to get more people tested quickly, it may have missed the mark. Over the course of a 3-month investigation, 60 Minutes has learned that federal officials knew many of the antibody tests were seriously flawed, but continued to allow them to be sold anyway. Now, as coronavirus surges in parts of the country, that government failure is complicating efforts to know the reach of the coronavirus.
The story will continue in a moment.
Laredo, Texas is a border town on the banks of the Rio Grande River. Population 270,000. It was founded in the 1700s as its own country. This spring, as it prepared to fight COVID, Laredo found itself alone on the frontier again.
Everybody was looking for supplies. Everybody was having challenges.
Robert Castaneda, a Laredo resident, owns 2 emergency clinics in town. He was desperately trying to find kits to test his patients for COVID-19.
It was maddening, to be honest with you. You go through your normal chain of distributors. Then you start hitting the wall with them, and they tell you that, you know, we're out. We talked to the local health department, and I spoke to the state health department. I even reached out to FEMA, talked to FDA. All your avenues of trying to get testing supplies were exhausted.
He says he went to his congressman's office for guidance and remarkably, in the waiting room, met a stranger who offered to connect him to a broker with access to antibody tests.
But you must have thought, sitting in that office and the guy says to you, "Hey, I might be able to help you out. This is terrific luck."
I mean, yeah, so it was a silver lining to that meeting. Exactly right.
And so tell me about the deal that was placed in front of you about buying this.
There was a minimum buy, and that minimum buy was 20,000 kits. So that, off the bat, was $500,000 to bring them into the city.
Was there a lot of guidance at that point at the state level or the federal level for procuring?
No, actually there was none.
In March, many communities were competing against each other and the federal government to find COVID tests. The Trump administration was under fire.
Anybody that needs a test gets a test. They're there. They have the tests. And the tests are beautiful.
But that was not true. Because of missteps a month earlier at both the Centers for Disease Control and the Food and Drug Administration, diagnostic tests, which can tell if a person is currently infected with a coronavirus, were in short supply. The promise of a new serology or antibody blood test that could determine if a person had been exposed to COVID-19 and developed protective antibodies was being heralded as the next best thing, a game changer that could get Americans back to work.
On March 16th, in an attempt to get those tests to the public, the FDA took an unusual step. It announced it would allow antibody tests into the U.S. market without FDA review or formal clearance.
Almost immediately, more than 100 companies offering antibody tests flooded the market. They came from every corner of the world, and none of them were FDA tested. Back in Laredo, Robert Castaneda agreed to the broker's deal and bought 20,000 antibody tests from a Chinese manufacturer, Anhui Deep Blue. He agreed to share them with the city of Laredo, where coronavirus cases were spiking.
The number of people testing positive for the virus continues going up.
Drive-through testing sites were readied around Laredo. The Chinese test kits arrived on March 30th, with the fanfare usually reserved for a winning high school football team in Texas.
We were elated, very happy, because now we were going to be able to test.
Dr. Hector Gonzalez was the director of health in Laredo for nearly two decades. The city wanted to start testing frontline responders as soon as possible. But first, Dr. Gonzalez, weeks away from his retirement, decided to test the accuracy of the antibody tests.
It was supposed to be 95%. All the tests, especially serologies, have to be 95% or better.
I had to gather tests from around the world.
Okay, it goes on. You can watch the whole segment for yourself. By the way, 60 Minutes could have done an accurate assessment of Margaret Hamburg's background and the controversy surrounding her. We did multiple shows on it. The same with Judy Gerberding, who was the head of the CDC, who left the CDC and went to work for the company that she is supposed to be overseeing their vaccine safety, Merck, in the MMR vaccine. That MMR vaccine, under Judy Gerberding's watch, was the basis of a major scandal in that the top, or one of the two top vaccinologists at the CDC, Dr. William Thompson, acknowledged to a Dr. Brian Hooker, whose son had autism and was seeking information from Dr. Thompson at the CDC, and Thompson just had this mea culpa moment where he acknowledged that, yeah, the MMR vaccine caused a 324% increase in autism spectrum disorder in African-American young boys 36 months and younger. Their kids, well, how many African-American young children would have been put at risk in the real world of developing autism? Over 100,000. So think of that for a moment. Judy Gerberding knew what was going on. Everyone at the CDC in the vaccine division knew what was going on. They had a problem. The word was that vaccines never cause autism. Yet in reality, there was a 324% increase in young children of color, boys in particular. That should have immediately stopped all MMR vaccines with an announcement that this is what they found. Instead, they got all the information together from all the people in that study, and they destroyed it. They were all put in black garbage bags, according to William Thompson, and yet he was the only one who didn't burn or destroy his material out of fear that if he was ever involved in a congressional hearing where he was under oath or a Freedom of Information Act request, and he had destroyed that, that's obstruction of justice. That you can be personally sued for. And the government will not, indemnification of all government employees will not cover you. So he kept a set. That set ended up in the hands of William Posey, the legislator from Florida, thousands and thousands of documents proving the MMR vaccine caused autism. Not once since then has he been able to get anyone to co-sponsor hearings, public hearings, to bring in all the people involved at CDC under oath and say, you knowingly falsified data and you knowingly destroyed evidence because you didn't want the vaccine to be exposed. And by the way, who do you think owns the patent on the vaccine? The American public pays for Merck and all these other vaccine companies to develop a vaccine, but then the patent is owned by the CDC or the U.S. Public Health Service, and then the doctors and scientists working on it are given a royalty. I think it's a maximum of $150,000 a year. But Judy Gerberding knew about all this because Thompson had sent all this information up the line, and she left there and went for Merck and made millions of dollars. In fact, one of her transactions was for $3.6 or $7 million in selling some of her stock. This is the revolving door, where a person goes from an important position within a government agency back into industry, and that could have been stopped a long time ago. But no administration, Democrat or Republican, no amount of legislators will pass a law allowing that, nor will they even allow the CDC to bring forth before Congress and to testify, because they'd be found guilty as hell. Overnight, nobody would take vaccines because everything you've been told about vaccines would be shown to be a lie. But as long as they can control all the doctors on television, which they do, and all the pundits talking about vaccines, which they do, and convince the major media that vaccines are safe and effective, which they've never been proven for any given person, then the lie continues. That's the part of that I would have challenged Dr. Hamburg on. But they didn't do their homework. We have, and I'm going to play the segment we did on Hamburg, because she had been the last person I would have brought on to interview if I had 60 minutes for truth. But let me take this a little further. This is from Joanne Rose from Global Research, and it is entitled Intelligence, Media, Disinformation, Science, and Medicine. I'll quote just a paragraph here. I work in the health field. Here's the problem. We are testing people for any strain of COVID virus, not specifically COVID-19. There are no reliable tests for a specific COVID-19 virus. There are no reliable agencies or media outlets for reporting numbers of actual COVID-19 virus cases. This needs to be addressed first and foremost. Every action and reaction to COVID-19 is based on totally flawed data, and we simply cannot make accurate assessments. This is why we're hearing that most people with COVID-19 are showing nothing more than cold, flu-like symptoms. That's because most COVID-19 strains are nothing more than cold, flu-like symptoms. The few actual novel coronavirus cases do have some worse respiratory responses, but still have a very promising recovery rate, especially for those without prior issues. The gold standard of testing for COVID-19 is laboratory-isolated purified coronavirus particles free from any contaminants and particles that look like viruses but are not, that have been proven to be the cause of the syndrome known as COVID-19 and obtained by using proper viral isolation methods and controls, not the PCR that is currently being used or serological antibody tests which do not detect virus as such. PCR basically takes a sample of your cells and amplifies any DNA to look for viral sequencing, i.e. bits of non-human DNA that seem to match parts of a known viral genome. The problem is the test is known not to work. It uses amplification, which means taking a tiny, very tiny amount of DNA and growing it exponentially until it can be analyzed. Obviously, any minute contaminations in the sample will also be amplified, leading to potentially gross errors of discovery. Additionally, it is only looking for partial viral sequences, not whole genomes, so identifying a single pathogen is next to impossible, even if you ignore the other issues. The Mickey Mouse test kits being sent out to hospitals at best tell analysts you have some viral DNA in your cells, which most of us do most of the time. In fact, anyone who's ever had a cold, that's a cold from the coronavirus. So how do you know when you get a test? Is it testing you for an old coronavirus that might have been in you for dozens of years or something new? And it can't distinguish that. It may tell you the viral sequence is related to a specific type of virus, say the huge family of coronaviruses, but that's all. The idea that kits can isolate a specific virus like COVID-19 is nonsense, and that's not even getting into the other issues like viral load. If you remember, the PCR works by amplifying minute amounts of DNA. It therefore is useless as telling you how much virus you have, and that's the only question that really matters when it comes to diagnosing illness. Everyone will have a few viruses kicking around in their system at any time, and most will not cause illness because their quantities are too small. For a virus to sicken you, you need a lot of it, a massive amount of it. But PCR does not test viral load and therefore cannot determine if it is present in sufficient quantities to sicken you. If you feel sick and get a PCR test, any random virus DNA might be identified even if they are not the actual cause of your problem. And coronaviruses are incredibly common. A large percentage of the world's human population will have coronavirus DNA in them in small quantities, even if they are perfectly well or sick with some other pathogen. Do you see where this is going yet? If you want to create a total false pandemic and panic about a totally false situation, pick a coronavirus. Coronaviruses are incredibly common, and there are many different strains. A very high percentage of people who have become sick by other means, the flu, bacterial pneumonia, anything, will have a positive PCR test for coronavirus, even if the testing is being done properly, simply because such viruses are so common. There are hundreds of thousands of flu and pneumonia victims in hospitals throughout the world at any given time. All you need to do is select the sickest of these in a single location, say Wuhan, China, administer PCR tests to tell them and claim anyone showing viral sequence similar to a coronavirus, which will inevitably be quite a few, is suffering from a new disease. And since you already selected the sickest flu cases, a fairly high proportion of your sample will naturally go on to die. You can then say that the new virus has a case fatality rate higher than the flu, and use this to infuse more concern and do more tests, which will, of course, produce more cases, which expands the testing, which produces yet more cases, and so on and so on. Before long, you have your pandemic, and all you have done is use a simple test kit trick to convert the worst flu and pneumonia cases into something new that doesn't need that emphasis. Anyhow, it goes on and on from there. And I think that we should be having discussions on this kind of information, because unless you get the right antibody test, unless you are giving the right kind of drugs for the person that has been diagnosed and is being treated, you're going to end up frequently over-treating a patient and killing them from over-treatment. That happens every day. How often? Approximately 1,900 people die every 24 hours from iatrogenesis or medically induced problems. Also, you have at least 4,000 people dying every 24 hours from heart disease and cancer. So if you look at how many people normally die in every country, then you take a look back over the last 12 months compared to the last 6 months and say, is there a unique spike in deaths? And if so, in what population, where, and what treatment or testing did they have? Like so many people were dying from the respirators itself. They were being overused instead of using proper means that they could use hyperbaric or you could use other things so you don't overinflate the lungs. They also, if you're treating for a virus, it's different than treating for a bacteria condition. And think of all the people who died because they were at home and who had diseases that required hospitalization, who were afraid to go in, or there was no space for them to go in. Think of all the surgeries that didn't happen, all the treatments for diabetes, emphysema, cancers, dementia, and those people died at home. So you see, until we have honest epidemiology by honest scientists who don't have something to gain by keeping it all as if this is the one, then there's wrong. But there are too many contradictions. If you say the children are not going to come down and die with this, and that's true, then why are they not in school and kindergarten? And if a teacher's concerned, she can wear an N99 mask and have distancing from the children. You can have all the desks and chairs cleaned between each class. You can do that. You could bring everyone back to school where they should be, but we're not doing that. So what we're not doing tells me who's controlling it and for what reasons. I look at not just an issue. I look at who controls the outcome of that issue. Is it political, ideological, or profitable, or all the above? And that's all we've done for the last 4 years, is take situations that did not exist in legitimacy, like the Russia hoax. And by the way, everything about the Russian hoax is now coming forward with documentation, real documentation, taken under oath, showing that we were lied to all across the board. No one should ever watch CNN and expect the truth or NSBC, because these people lied. The people they had on as guests lied. And because under oath, in secret, they acknowledged there was no Russian collusion, no proof of it at all. The only proof there was of someone colluding with the Russian government and Putin was Hillary Clinton and a uranium deal. That's what caused all this, because they were terrified that the public would be concerned about the Clintons and Clinton Foundation getting all those millions and hundreds of millions of dollars from the uranium deal. And so you put up a smokescreen. But we seem to have a press that is not interested in the truth or justice. It's all political, all ideological, all the time. And that is unfortunate. Now, to the problems we're faced with every day. The average person, certainly all the people I've ever met and know in my life, and all the people I've worked with, been friends with, associated with, they simply want a simpler life. They've worked hard at creating a responsible environment for themselves, their spouses, their children, to be a responsible member of communities of all types, all ethnicities, all backgrounds, all religions. When I go over to Brooklyn and I help people within the ultra-Orthodox community, or I give a lecture for them, which I have, and many times I help them, I'm always interested in how they're doing as a society, as a group, and what are they faced with? How are they perceived by the rest of the world, as with respect or with disdain? And I see that everywhere I go around the world, because I look at everyone and ask them these questions. So most people, the vast majority of people, are not racist. They want peace. They want harmony. And unless you brought it up and suddenly question your relationship to a person of a different ethnicity, then people just accept, this is my friend. No, we don't get together and talk about race. We get together as friends. They're not my friend because of the color of their skin or their religious background or their education or their gender. They're my friend because they're my friend. They're a sacred person. When I look at people as a member of the human race, and I value everyone, and I see the merits of human beings communicating, it's not being naive. There are people who are racist. There are people who are bigamists. There are people who lie and cheat. Do you think all the people who commit adultery are not liars? They have to lie to their spouses and their family members in order to commit that personal treasonous act. You're betraying the person that has trusted you. If you couldn't be in the relationship, be honest and get out of it. So we are a nation of all backgrounds that engage on a daily basis in either trying to make our lives work or trying to take shortcuts and make excuses why they don't. So instead of showing violence of any type or distemper, show commitment to what your ideal is and then work collectively together with everyone to try to change it. How would I change it? Well, I won't go into that today. I don't have time. It's going to take a half hour. But I'll show you how to change the entire justice system, change the for-profit system, the debtors' prisons, to change the usurious rates of credit cards and what puts people in desperate situations to begin with, change how police are trained, change responsibility to have people from local communities serve in those local communities with civilian oversight, all that that's positive I'll show tomorrow. But also I want to acknowledge how much progress we've made because of the people who believed in nonviolent demonstration, of speaking truth to power. And I commend them, because when you denigrate everything that nothing's changed, then you also dismiss all the work of all the leaders. And I can name 100 off the top of my head who I respect, who caused us to be able to have the rights for all people that we have. Barbara Seaman was a close friend of mine. We did a major book together, 1,600-page book. We traveled the United States lecturing, doing PBS specials. Why? Because there was a need for more spiritual feminism, bringing the spiritual in, where you didn't hate men and denigrate men. You understood how to cooperate so that everyone's interests and needs and communication was proper. That has not been done in a long time. We're into the blame, the shame, and the erasure of a person's reputation, their life, their work, because it doesn't meet with a particular artificial construct of what the new reality is. So there's two things I want to get into before the end of the show, and we're going to go a little over, 5 minutes over, for all of our syndicated shows. Our sister station, BAI in New York, has to be out in about 3 minutes. So I want to give you the religious perspective on how to resolve issues worldwide in just a moment. And I honor all those religions as contributing to how we're able to survive, no matter what our obstacles, wars, conflicts, pogroms, anti-Semitism, racism, amongst all people. I mean, every group you can imagine coming to America had its day of infamy, where it was targeted, it was isolated, it was prejudiced. People were defined as lower caste, and like the Irish and the Italians and the Germans, so many people. And I'm going to give you a history of each of those groups in the United States starting tomorrow. In any case, I just want to quickly mention that WBAI is going through a rough time. If you could be a buddy, that would help them, where they take a small amount of money every month on a rotating basis. That pays bills. I have been on there pitching for a long time because nobody asked me. I volunteer, but I don't get a call in return. So to help the station pay its bills, the last 2 weeks of October, we're doing a sleepaway, a health retreat, where you're going to get great food, you're going to have a great time, you're going to get lectures, counseling, yoga, meditation, you're going to see a hydroponic project in progress, you're going to see freeze-drying, all these things you can do for yourself with intentional communities. That's the future. That's a whole day I'm going to talk about where to live, how to get there, who to be with, who not to be with. If you want to do it on your own, I'll show you how, or with a group, family, and friends. So surviving the future with all the problems we have, that's at least one whole day of this 1 to 2 weeks. So if you want to join us, call this number. You'll speak with Luann Panessi. This is so that BAI can pay its bills now. 903-881-7008. 903-881-7008. And by the way, I'm donating my time. A whole group comes in, about 20 staff, to donate their time in order for us to help the station. And we figure we can buy about 3,000 premiums that won't burden the station because it doesn't have the money now. And we will buy them immediately and send them out, because there's about 500 premiums that haven't been sent out because there's no money to pay for them. So we will do that. And once we exceeded my program's needs, we will then start to work with other producers to buy their premiums so that the people, listeners, get them. So if you want to join me for 1 to 2 weeks, that could change your life. It's certainly going to be distressing and loving and kind and creative and inspirational. You can do as little or as much as you want. You're going to learn classes in vegan cooking. My daughter Shelley will be there doing our chefing when she's not out walking around nature. Shelley, time to work. What? Yeah. Get in the kitchen, Shelley. So my daughter's a wonderful cook and a great teacher. She'll be doing all kinds of classes, fermentation classes, how to start your own business from a new place, a new location, wherever you choose to move. But I'll show you the best places to move. So give a call if you want to be a part of that. And when we're filled, we're full. And we always fill up. 903-881-7008. 703-813-8170-08. The only people this wouldn't for are really negative, angry, toxic people. That energy we can't help, and that wouldn't benefit you. Now, I want to finish off today's show by explaining that more than ever before, our world needs a new ethical standard. When I see a group of white, late teenagers, meaning 18, 19, 20, 21 years old, getting in the face of a black police officer who's standing there not saying a word, and curse her, using racial epithets, threatening her, demeaning her, which itself is racist, I have to ask, how in the effort to be a part of an anti-racist movement, you're racist and that is forgiven? You should be able to be held accountable for your actions. And do you think that that's going to influence that police officer who herself is black? You know nothing about her. You know nothing about her family. So we need a different way. And since the world is now globalized, this ethic should be global also. And such an ethic must rely upon a new understanding of reality. The current dominant scientific view of reality is insufficient, it's reductionist, it's determinist, it's materialistic, that perceives humans as nothing more than machines with a computer in their skulls. The other reality is violence works, burn it down, beat them up, kill them if need be, get your way, and that's what we're also seeing, not in the majority, but in a very fierce minority. They're not there to honor anyone. They're there for their own ideological reasons. And some of these are identifying as Marxists. I can assure you that Marx would not support what they're doing. So there are two sources for creating a new ethics. The new sciences that go far beyond a materialistic understanding of the world and ourselves, such as quantum physics, and the new sciences looking at the mind and consciousness as something that extends far beyond our cells or the brain's neurons. Plus, the world's religions. Despite whether you are religious or spiritual or not, the fact remains that the vast majority of the 7.6 billion people on this planet either believe in a higher being, some divine reality, and identify them with a particular religious faith. 32% of the world's population are Christian. That's about 2.3 billion. That's the largest in the world. Islam, 24% of 1.8 billion. Hinduism, 15% of 1.1 billion. Buddhism, 7.1% or 500 million. Then various Chinese and African folk religions. Native American and indigenous religions account for 6%, about 400 million. Jews make up about 0.2% or 10 million people. And the smaller faiths like Jains, Sikhs, Taoists, Zoroastrians make up about 1% or 58 million. 1.2 billion do not identify with any religious faith. They can be spiritual, atheist, humanist, or agnostic. What they all have in common is this. William Blake said, a theme that is very consistent with religious persons who are not dogmatic and can see the commonalities religions share rather than focus on differences and competition between them. All try to wrestle out some sense of order and harmonious ethical response to chaos, a sense of community, community that is inclusive, community cohesion, which has numerous social, psychological, and spiritual factors, such as supportive infrastructure. Of course, all religions speak against violence and murder and stealing and lying and slander and dishonoring parents. All religions have what is called the golden rule, do unto others what you would have them do to you. In mystical parlance, this is called the law of reciprocity. The mystical elements in each religion address overcoming our egotistical and selfish nature and encourage us to discover an interconnectedness with each other and the natural world and environment. Thus, all religions share instructions on generosity and giving. Islam, for example, has what is known as zakat among its five major pillars, which is giving 3% of your income to charity. Every religion has some form of ecological teaching, whether it is followed or not. In his book, Towards a True Kinship of Faith, How the World's Religions Can Come Together, the Dalai Lama says that when he was growing up, he thought his own Buddhist religion was the best religion in the world. He said, I thought that there simply could not be any other faith tradition that could rival the depth, sophistication, and inspirational power of Buddhism. But as he met serious practitioners of other religious traditions, particularly after he fled Tibet and went into exile, he changed his opinion. The one thing the Dalai Lama feels ties all religions and people together is the role of compassion. He says, it is my fundamental conviction that compassion, the natural capacity of the human heart to feel concern for and connection with another being, constitutes a basic aspect of our nature shared by all human beings, as well as being the foundation of our happiness. He says that it is the ethics upon which religious and secular views converge, and that compassion is central to all ethical religious systems. If our task to cultivate peaceful coexistence, and if the vast majority of the world is religious and peaceful, then it is our shared human experience, which includes suffering and misery, and all of us being faced with the same threats from climate change, inequality, economic worries, capitalism, globalization, illness and death, then our shared experience is where we can find solutions and antidotes into the greatest spiritual teachers of the past and present. We can still have a pluralist view of others' views without compromising our own. A science tells us that we should not perceive our belief or any others as completely absolute. That is the pitfall and where religion becomes tyrannical. Thank you all for listening. I'm Gary Nall, and have a nice day.